0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. Now, we've been getting nominations for women that our listeners think should be placed and honoured in this new women's museum that we're now talking about having. And let me tell you, the nominations are rolling in, but there's one name that has been particularly popular. Maria, good afternoon.
Hey, Katie, how's it going?
Yeah, you are nominating somebody that, a number of our listeners have want to nominate for the new women's museum. Who is it?
It's Vicky Phelan, without a doubt.
Yeah. Obviously, and I mean, we're not even, it's not even, we haven't even reached our first anniversary, the first anniversary
exactly,
of Vicky's
yeah.
passing yet, but she means a huge amount to so many women up and down this country.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. I mean, I just always was in admiration of Vicky from when she first came into the limelight with the whole, you know, cervical scandal cases and all that. And she saved so many women's lives. She was such an advocate for women. But she was also very much involved in highlighting education and the importance of it as well. I remember last year there was Emily Quinn did a project for the Art of Strength this March this year, mm-hmm. I think. And she took photographs of Vicky, who was portraying Hannah Sheehy Skeffington at the time. And she fought for women's rights like Vicky, and they both felt the importance of education. I think Emily also took the photograph for the cover of her book, Overcoming, which I read and was deeply affected by. I just think she was an amazing woman. Like, you know, I myself am in education. I returned as a mature student. I'm 55 in my last year in Trinity.
Doing oh my God, Maria. Fair play to you. That is
doing.
So you went back to college at, like, you were into your 50s before you went back.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
wow.
I went through the Trinity Access Program. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm trying to get it out there.
Some amazing, the TAP program. Yeah, amazing people have come through that from backgrounds that would normally never get a shot at Trinity.
Exactly. I'm from Finglas myself, so it's classed as an underprivileged area, and people who, you know, they had the brains years ago, they just didn't get the opportunities to go back to education. And the Trinity Access Programme, I would just highly recommend it for everybody. And now here I am in my final year. It's flown by and I can't believe it. But as I said, Vicky was really into, you know, highlighting the importance of education as well. And yeah, she received an accolade in Limerick as well, university where she studied. So,
yeah, so she was just an inspiration for you and for so many others.
Exactly, yeah.
What struck me about her, and I did interview her in another studio in this building some years ago, and she was just the most phenomenal communicator in terms of the passion and the clarity of, you know, what she wanted to get across.
Exactly. And she took time out for everybody. Like, when I write a bit of poetry myself, and when I, after reading her book, I dedicated a poem to her. I put it up on my Twitter page, didn't think anything of it. And she actually contacted me and said, thanks for it. Now, you know, that to me is something I will, treasure. I'll cherish that for as long as I live, because that, for her just to come, like, all she was going through, and just to take time out and say thanks.
I've heard so many of those stories over the last number of years. When you think about what she was juggling, what she was going through,
exactly.
what she was managing in her own, she had her own family life to deal with, and her kids and her illnesses and the various challenges there. And yet you hear so many of little gestures that she actually made the effort to reach out to people to thank or to acknowledge or to give a little lift to.
Yeah.
Very, very, very special person.
Definitely, yeah.
Marie, will you hang on? Because I have John Clarkin on the line. John, good afternoon.
Hello, Kate. How are you?
John, people down in Limerick way will know you are, of course, Vicky's dad.
That's right, yeah. Well, we might visit Limerick, but we're from Kilkenny originally. And I'd just like to say thanks to Marie there for that nomination.
You're welcome. No problem, John.
You know, John, we all know, you know, all of us know Vicky now as the campaigner and as, you know, somebody who you know, blazed a trail and was an inspiration to the likes of Maria. But can you just tell us a little bit about what it was like being, you know, what Vicky was like as a daughter and as a mother?
Well, she was very headstrong to start with, anyway, but a very special mother.
Where did she get that from, John?
I think she might have picked that up from me, I think, the stubbornness. But look, she was just an amazing daughter to us, you know, after sharing so much together as a family, you know. And our health was deteriorating at this stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we heard of, we shared so much love, I suppose, so much joy, happiness together. It was amazing. She was very, you know, at her early age, like education was basically her main goal, you know, and she was very driven. And as the head of the household, of course, she was very determined.
Yeah, because you're from a really big family yourself, John, aren't you?
Well, one of 16, and for me, I'm number 13, and whether that's lucky or unlucky, I don't know, but that's where I come in anyway.
Wow,
but she was the first of our children to go to, the whole family actually, to make college. So that was in itself, I suppose, was a big deal on the time, like back in the early 70s, before our accident, you know. And, at the head of our family, you know, she became a kind of self-appointed boss. You know, she had so much drive and determination to succeed, was one of her great assets. And this was nurtured probably from a very early age, you know. And we all got to see Vicky, of course, and all her courage and bravery, of course, and the steps of the forecourts. So it's no surprise to us, you know, as our principles and morals were of a very high standard. And, you know, she leaves a great legacy for us in Amelia and Dara. That's probably our legacy.
What age was she when she started school, John?
She was 3.5.
That's what I thought. She
insisted with the teacher that she was able to read, so she actually gave her a book and she was able to read from. So I said, okay. 4 was actually the starting age, like, you know, but she was very persistent.
Wow. Yeah. So, and she herself was determined to go?
That's just look, she was very determined, like, and that was one of our big assets, like her determination and drive, you know.
She loved
education. She went to France, like, at an early age, and I think in 1992, I think, 2 years before her accident there on Erasmus program there, doing languages, and that's how she ended up having her accident. And from there, everything kind of snowballed after that. Like,
yeah, because that was the first major health challenge that Vicky had to overcome.
And they kind of accumulated after that, like between, you know, her depression after Daryl's birth and Amelia's accident. And, you know, after Amelia's birth as well, she went into a good bit of depression that time for a long time, you know. But she took up running, and that was one of our main goals, and that got her through the depression, I think.
And of course,
she trained, actually, from a lot of people might know, is that she did train for a marathon, in the Belfast City Marathon, in 2008. And done a remarkable time down 4 hours and 8 seconds.
So having taken up running just basically to kind of get her head in the right place,
for
her mental health,
place, yeah,
and her physical health, of course, as well. But she actually, of course, being Vicky Phelan, she didn't just start running, she ran a whole marathon.
Well, that was the only one she ran, but it was a disaster for us on the day because we were to be bringing our bottles to our stations, but we couldn't get to any of them at the piers, and so we were kind of blocking every road that's in the place. We never even got to see her at the finish, so that'll tell you. It's a bit disappointing, but it's a great weekend at the same time.
Yeah, God, it's some achievement though, given that she was coming back from that accident.
Oh, it was a great achievement, really. There's just so many bones broke in that accident. Like, it was hard to believe that she was back, actually, I'd say at least 9 months after that accident, she was back running. So, you know, she had great determination that way.
Yeah.
Like you were saying there about the honour there that they're trying to bestow, or that you had a nomination there for.
Yeah,
we've been on days yourself with so many messages of support, you know, from people. It's incredible, you know, to think that one person could be loved by so many, I suppose. So I'm not surprised, I suppose, at the accolades that people wanted to bestow upon us, I suppose. And as we felt like the Women's Museum of Ireland would be a great honour for Vicky, of course, and for the family as well.
It'd be kind of hard to imagine a Women's Museum of Ireland without Vicky in it, you know, in terms of the impact that she's had.
Even for us, it's hard to believe she's not around either, but we kind of go to all the Vicky Field campaign and poster tours, like we were in Gut last week, and great turnout as well. Like. So that actually helps us in our grieving process as well. Like.
How have you all been for the last year, John?
Yeah, it's been tough. But I'll have to say the two kids, Amelia and Dara, I can't get over how well they're after coping. But now, look, we go up probably every 2 weeks, roughly. Gaby might go up maybe sooner. But we go up every 2 weeks, keeping them and check and see how they're doing. Like, Jim is doing well now as well, in fairness. So it's not just the two kids, like. Mm-hmm. But Amelia has been working all the summer. She got a job in a bookshop, so that's her favourite thing. Like, so she's really delighted with that. So, I mean, that helped as well, like. And Dara's into the sports in a big way. So, you know, they're getting on okay.
Yeah. Listen, I'm sure the whole country is wishing you all the very, very best. John, thank you so much. And as I say, Maria, thank you so much for that nomination. And as I say, not the only one. Vicky's name is coming up with our callers. And as I say, we're not surprised. John, thank you for that. And Maria, I'm going to bring in Michael now. Michael Martin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
You have another nomination for me, Michael.
Yeah, I want to nominate a group of ladies, actually, who were established in 1988 and called themselves the National Army Spouses Association, or NASA for short. I think the activities that they undertook and the initiatives that they were involved in helped change the life of people serving in the Defence Forces forevermore. And their actions later resulted in, you know, legislation being changed that brought about the voice of association for members of our armed forces.
Yeah, because remind us, back at that time, there was no right to representation, basically. If you were serving, there was no way you could get you could speak out or in any way organise for better terms.
No, you had no means to orchestrate any initiatives to improve your pay, your conditions, and, you know, your careers and so on. You're prohibited from speaking to the media. Of course, serving personnel's wives and girlfriends didn't suffer any prohibition. So they organised themselves. There were people like Margaret Kiernan and Mullingar, and was a lady called Margaret O'Connor up in Donegal, and others in Dublin, Carol Tiernan, I remember. But they all organised this group where they began to raise awareness about how badly paid members of the Defence Forces were, how difficult their career choices were, how little opportunity that they had for promotion and so on, at a time when soldiers couldn't articulate this publicly at all. And not long after they had begun their campaign to raise awareness about and look for improvements in conditions, not long after that, they would have, encouraged politicians, influencers. Mm-hmm. They undertook protest marches. They picketed outside of army barracks and so on, none of which the soldiers could do at the time, or the sailors, or the Air Force personnel. They led the charge, really.
Were you serving at the time, Michael?
I was a serving member in the Navy at the time, yeah. And, you know, we would have been all strictly prohibited from speaking to the press or the media. And the women sort of the National Army Spouses Association sort of developed an opinion that the reason that soldiers, sailors, Air Force personnel's pay had fallen so far behind was that they didn't have a representative body, whereas all the other uniformed services in the country had either a trade union or a representative association. So they felt this was a key element of trying to improve things. So they began to campaign for a right of association for members of the armed forces. And I was one that was serving. There were many others that got involved later that were serving too.
Mm-hmm. And of course, people will say not to get too political about it, but there's similar issues at play at the moment, and there's spouses are also out campaigning to this day.
Yeah.
But it was a sort of a radical and, you know, a way to get around the situation that, that the men found themselves in.
Yeah, it was unheard of at the time. And, you know, for the first time ever, you know, the sort of concerns of ordinary enlisted personnel was on the national airwaves, in the newspapers, you know, on the television screens at night. So it was the raising awareness of those issues that got, you know, politicians who mightn't have even thought about that before. They're like the unseen, like, you know, nobody talks much about the Navy until something like the other day happens. And what I would say is there's still a long way to go. Representative bodies are there doing a fabulous job. And the thing is, if things are bad now and people are still campaigning, they would be 100 times worse if those organisations hadn't been there plugging away, because they're plugging away tirelessly since their foundation in 1990. But I would suggest that, you know, the legislation that changed, the Defence Amendment Act of 1990 and all that flowed from it, probably would have never happened had it not been for, you know, the women
Army
of NASA. Yeah, absolutely. They really turned the whole thing on its head and got profile for problems for a group. I mean, I don't know of any other organisation of women who were fighting specifically for the rights of men. No, so I think that's unique and different as well. And the thing is, their raising of awareness really helped, because soldiers later on pursued, you know, this right of association. They went to Europe, they took it to the High Court and so on, and legislation was passed. But the people who began all of that were the women.
The Army. Okay, your line is breaking down a little bit, but we've got the nomination, and it's a good one. That's from Michael Martin, and he's nominating the National Army Spouses to have a place in the museum. The museum we don't have yet, of course, but we're hopeful. We travel in hope. Can I bring in Joe? Oh, it's Joe Little. Joe, good afternoon.
Katie, how are you?
Joe, how are you? How's retirement?
Retirement is the promised land, Katie. We should all aim to try to live up to the time that we can legitimately retire.
Okay, we're all doing that, Joe, at this end of it. You have a good nomination.
Margaret McCurtain. Sister Benvenuta was her name in religion until she got the option, because of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, to go back to her birth name, her baptism name, Margaret McCurtain, Sister Margaret McCurtain, lecturer in history in University College Dublin. She was a devout Dominican nun, a feminist historian, and an educational reformer. In the words of her Irish Independent obituarist, she insisted that nuns should be more than cooing doves serving the leadership of the Catholic Church, the male leadership of the Catholic Church. And she made an indelible mark on Irish education and on wider Irish and indeed on international society. She spent, true to her ability to think things through and to feel for people, is, I think, that she spent several months in hospital in Listowel as a little girl suffering from diphtheria in very, very bleak surroundings. And she attributes some of her capacity to think through and to think about the transcendent possibilities in life and overcoming adversity to that period in hospital. And, of course, she became a great reader when in hospital in Listowel. She was reared in Cork.
I was going to say, what's the connection with Listowel? I always associated
her
with
father,
Cork.
Her father was a schools inspector. So he, while they were having their children, his wife and himself travelled around North Kerry and County Cork and ended up in Cork itself, Cork City. And unlike many girls at the time, the McCurtain girls, there was a group of sisters there, they all went to university. A clue to that may be found in the fact that their mother was a banker Their mother was a banker in London. She was working in the bank in London. She came back to to marry, and obviously gave up her career. But clearly, her daughters were motivated by mom at home, you know, to do their studies and to get on. And Margaret McCurtain did an arts degree and was a political activist in UCC. And at the age of 21, surprised her family by announcing that she was going to join the Dominican nuns and go into a convent. She had done a HDIP and she saw herself as being a secondary teacher as a nun. But when she was teaching girls in Sion Hill in Dublin, she found it necessary to apply to go and do an MA in order to be able to respond to the penetrating questions from many of those young women. And she did a master's, went on to the doctorate, and was appointed to a temporary staff job in UCD in 1964. Mm-hmm. And she served there for 30 years, with the exception of 3 years where she obtained leave of absence to go and establish Ballyfermot Senior College, which is close to a Dominican convent school in Ballyfermot. And the Dominicans had a presence there. And it was the first post-Leaving Cert college to be established in the country. And she took great pride from the fact that it gave more opportunity to children who were traditionally cut out of participation in third level. Because at that time, I was a third level student, I remember. We were campaigning in the student unions to open access to education because only about a fifth of school leavers were managing to graduate from third level courses in the early 70s.
This is the thing, but also, like, I think there's a lot of women, nuns actually, of that era as well, that had an huge commitment to educating women, to educating girls at that time, at a time when maybe it was still considered a bit of a waste of time to be, you know, giving an expensive education to girls. And I'm even thinking back to pre-Donna O'Malley's time, to those schools that were set up around the country. There was one that my mother would have gone to in Abbeyfeel. It was run by a Mrs. Wolfe. And they were for a small amount of money, they were like private operations and generally. Girls that would never have had an opportunity to go beyond national school, primary school, were given this education. And there was these incredible women who really broke the mould in doing that.
A professor in Maynooth, Father Liam Ryan, Professor Liam Ryan, did a study of Balmacora Weston in Limerick called Social Dynamite. And he pointed to the inevitable career of young girls as carers for their siblings, and then they were sent out to work in the textile industry and many other industries in order to bring in money, often into a single parent household or a household where the father had emigrated and maybe wasn't getting the remittances that were able to support the family, you know, back into his wife's purse. So the girls were the mainstay, because girls mature more quickly than boys. Girls were the industrial and service workforce, you know, as I remember it around Limerick, and working in factories like Cleves. You would see them coming down the Shannon, you know, in their nylon work coats after lunch, in a big gang, all laughing and having fun during the summer, and then coming in doing very hard work in the condensed milk factory in Cleves. That was society in Ireland. That they were the limited horizons of many, many women of no property in this country, and women of little property. And men often saw it as a waste of time, you know, educating their daughters. Therefore, Margaret's parents were very enlightened in ensuring, they called her Peg, ensuring that Peg got an education in third level education.
And she did that thing that we say now. She passed it on. She passed it on,
and she wanted to write her major calling in academia was to write the history of Irish women, begin the writing of history of Irish women. And she put up a proposal in the early 1970s. This is according to her friend and colleague, Mary O'Dowd, writing in Irish Historical Studies. She put up a proposal in the early 70s with two other colleagues for a course comparing the history of female suffrage, you know, women getting the vote in Britain, Ireland and the United States. The proposal, Mary O'Dowd says, was rejected by the History Department and UCD. Accusations of lack of subjectivity and the scarcity of sources, historical written sources, reflected the academic refusal at the time, Mary says, to consider the history of women as a legitimate field of study. And then Margaret had to motivate students themselves to take an interest in this subject. And she did that. I remember her. I was a member of the staff student committee in first year in UCD and sat across the table from her. And she was a wonderful motivator because she had a very gentle manner. Mm-hmm. She would often say to people, her friends recalled, her favourite phrase was, go for it. You know, when she was talking to a student, and she radiated a great joy and optimism.
You've obviously a great deal of affection for her, Joe.
She came to me, Katie, once to explain why UCD had withdrawn its offer of a second seat on its governing body in 1975-76 for the student union to take a second seat. And she was involved in college politics at the time. I think she was on the academic council. But she found me in the student union office on a Friday evening when she was leaving work. And I was there on my own, so she was able to talk to me confidentially. She said, I'm sure you're wondering why the president, Tom Murphy, has withdrawn his offer of a second seat to the student union. I said, yeah, come to think of it. We were all kind of really gobsmacked by that. And we had nothing in writing from him. It was an oral promise. And she said, well, what's happened is that the conservative, secretive Catholic organisations have got on to the county councillors and city councillors who constitute a third of the governing body, and they've told them, if you nominate a second student union rep to the governing body in UCD, we're going to label you as pro-contraception, because the UCD student union was providing a free contraceptive service because we couldn't sell contraceptives due to the 1935 Criminal Justice Act. And that they were going to be blackened at the polls, at the hustings, next time that they went forward for election as county and city councillors, or indeed as TDs or senators, as being pro-contraception. And she was burning with integrity. She wanted to tell me that. She thought that knowing that and walking around college and seeing me, she had dealt with me, she owed me as a debt of honour to come and tell me what had actually happened. Right. And I always treasure that honesty. She was a true Catholic. She imitated the ideals laid out in the New Testament. She was a really honest person. And she paid for it. You know, when she came back from Ballyfermot to take up her position in UCD, she had to go to the High Court and get an injunction, because UCD said, you can't work in a full-time teaching job because you've been appointed prior of Sion Hill Convent, which was a part-time job, she said. She was well able to do the two jobs. But she had to go to the High Court to get her full-time job back.
Okay, Joe, we've got loads more coming in, but you've made a great case for her. That's Dr. Margaret McCurtain should be in the new Women's Museum if we get one. That's according to Joe Little. Thanks for that, Joe. Good to talk to you. Now, can I bring Monica in? Monica, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Katie. I wanted to nominate Maureen De Burka. I'm 66 now, but I first heard her name mentioned by my mother in relation to it was a member of our family who was looking for housing at the time, and now this was around 1768, and at that time there was a very bad housing problem like today in Dublin. I think tenements had collapsed, and there was a group called the Dublin Housing Action Committee. I think Maureen De Burka was a member of that, but this relation of ours had gone to her looking for help to find housing. She had no help from the corporation, and she was very impressed, as was my mother, by Maureen De Burka, because when my relation went in to see her, she actually got up, put on her coat and marched with her up to Dublin Corporation, where I don't know where it was at the time. But, you know, working class women had very little power and very little voice and very little sort of confidence at that time. And I was only a child, but I thought to myself, like, there's somebody who really cares about people, you know?
Yeah, she was an incredible woman, actually. And she was an activist. She was a journalist. She, you know, she was an administrator. But she took part in a lot of campaign. Like, there's a brilliant story of her. She was on the Irish Voice on Vietnam. She was campaigning against the Vietnamese War.
She
threw eggs at Nixon's motorcade.
Well, she was
in
actually
Dublin.
In prison for 3 months for that, you know. I mean, at that time, there were she's kind of in the mould of a Bernadette Devlin, you know. At that time, there would have been, you know, there wouldn't have been that many women activists like her. You know, not just a politician, but somebody who doesn't mind getting their hands dirty. You know, you wouldn't have seen that many of them around. And I think she was a founder member of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement as well. And she was General Secretary for Sinn Féin, which, you know, I suppose there wouldn't have been that many women prominent in political organisations then, and especially a movement like that, which at the time would have been very male-dominated, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was involved with prisoners' rights as well, you know, so and the anti-apartheid movement. And I remember RTÉ did a programme on her, and I was just so impressed by her. As kind of somebody who was brought up in a working-class area in Dublin, you know, I just thought, like, this is someone to aspire to, you know?
Absolutely. OK, that's another one for us there now then. Maureen De Burka.
Okay.
Thank you, Monica. A great
Thank
one.
You. Bye.
Thanks for
Bye.
Reminding us of Maureen De Burka. And please, if you have somebody you think should be honoured in this way, let us know. Our text is 51551 or send us a WhatsApp on 087 184 3709. That's 087 184 3709.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And as I say, they're coming in thick and fast now. Brendan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Who are you nominating, Brendan?
I would like to nominate three sisters who lived in the early part of the 1900s down in Valentia in Kerry. And one of them particularly, Maud Delap. Delap is the surname. Maud Delap was a marine biologist, as were her two sisters, but she was probably the formidable scientist of the three of them. And her claim to fame was in the study of plankton. That's the stuff that kind of floats in the sea. And there are two main types of plankton. There's planktonic plants, which we call phytoplankton, and there's planktonic animals, which we call zooplankton. And one type of zooplankton are jellyfish. They float around in the seas, but nobody until Maud came along actually described the life cycle of this particular organism. And it's a little bit unusual in the sense that it spends part of its earliest life on the seabed. You could almost describe it as a small plant-like structure. And from that are budded off these little larval jellyfish in the springtime, and they grow and grow and grow. So you get to see them then eventually in the early summer and into the autumn. And the one that she particularly worked on was a thing called Chrysaora isocella, and most people would know that as the compass jellyfish. It's got these brown triangles along the back.
There's been plenty of them around the last few summers down in Kerry, actually.
Yeah, they're actually present throughout the coast. They're not limited to one particular coast, any particular coast. Some jellyfish are, and I happen to study jellyfish from my BSc here in UCG, and so I came across her name a long time ago. But it wasn't until actually a sculptor called Dorothy Cross, you might have come across her,
yes,
came across this woman and understood how ahead of her time she was, and her sisters in taking on marine science like that and pursuing it, in which was a male-dominated science.
What's the story, though? I mean, three sisters in Valentia in 1920, were they, like, they must have been That would be extremely unusual, as we were just talking about Dr. Margaret McCurtain there. The, you know, there weren't a lot of women definitely in the sciences at that time. Do we know, was it a family background that brought them to it?
No, their dad was actually a C of I minister down there. One of the suggestions is that a British biologist at the time, a fellow called Brown, chose Valencia as a place to study. And he bumped into the sisters. And there's another sub-story there too, maybe, that there was some kind of a tryst between Maud and this man, C.T. Brown. But it never developed into anything serious because her dad wouldn't let her walk out with this fella.
Right. I'm thinking a movie. I'm wondering who we're going to cast as Maud in this.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, so it was the coincidence of this.
We think so.
Wow, incredible story. Never heard of the Delaps the Delaps sisters. But definitely,
absolutely great.
Definitely want to hear more, and that is the whole point of a museum. Of course, it's to bring you to people and names that you would never normally have known about. That's a great one, Brendan. Thanks a million for that.
You're very welcome, Katie. All the best.
Okay, take care. And
bye.
Take care. 51551, if you have any more nominations for us. Geraldine, good afternoon. Do I have Geraldine up at the line? Okay, we'll hang on. We'll try and get Geraldine again if she's not there. No, okay. I'll go to Eamon now. Eamon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, you want to nominate another group of women.
A group of women? I don't know the names, Katie. But it's to do with the 40 foot. It was in Sandy Cove.
I know it well, and, yeah.
Yeah, the swimming place. You know, it's absolutely magical place. And in 1974, you had these peacocks patrol and no women allowed. You know, and I meant if you went there with your missus or your moth, they take a back seat and you went in and had your swim, you know that way.
Yes.
But one Sunday in 74, I think 13 or 14 women arrived and that was the end of it. There was no big fuss, there was no nothing. Just get out of the way. Yeah, we're going to have a swim here. And that ended that smashed the ban. You know, on female swimmers in the 40 foot.
Yeah, wasn't Nell McCafferty one of the main protagonists there in that gang? I know it was reported as an invasion of the 40 foot at the time.
So, yeah, I think Nell was there. Whether she swam or not, I don't know, but I think she was there. Why I'm ringing you, Katie, there was no fuss, there was no nothing. Over the years, I've suggested to women from that area that be swimming there, to put a little plaque or something, just that maybe the Dunleary Council or something. Because, it's a lovely place to swim. And it features in Joyce's, the fourth chapter of Ulysses, you know? And Sam Beckett swam there. You know, it's my Mrs. Pauline, and she, the last swim she had there was in 2013. And it was 8:15 in the evening. It was September the 20th, and it wasn't very warm. And she was going down the steps, and she was reciting a Stevie Smith poem, The Forlorn Sea. You know, just to divert herself from the cold weather, you know?
Yeah. I'm looking here at a report of the invasion 40 years ago.
Yeah.
By Nell. It was actually... written by Nell. According to Nell McCafferty, the women invaded by land, sea and air. Among them was the late Nuala Fennell. Among them was the late Nuala Fennell and the poet Mary Darcy.
Now we have it. Yes.
Mary Darcy arrived by Corrock. I jumped off a rock with an umbrella, and Nuala Fennell and her husband and two children took possession of a nearby rock, McCafferty said.
No surrender.
It sounded like actually the best crack, I have to say. So it was. But what the whole issue, of course, was that men used to swim in the nip at the 40 foot, wasn't that?
In the words of Sean O'Casey, paycocks. You know, Yeah. Well, so could women. So what? You know what I mean, Katie?
Absolutely.
It was terrible. Like, I'd go out with Pauline, and she was a very strong-minded woman there, you know, and she used to say, I'm not having that, but she needed a little push, you know?
Eamon, that is an excellent, excellent suggestion for that museum.
Yeah.
I would love to hear that story told again and that moment remembered, and I'm sure many more people would as well.
Yeah, what I told you about Pauline was, myself and the grandkids go out on the 20th of September every year to commemorate our last swim there, you know?
Oh.
Well, that's it. So listen, Katie, it's great to talk to you.
Okay. That's a lovely story, Eamon. And it's a lovely memory and lovely place to go to share it. Listen, thank you for that, Eamon. I have to take another break. We'll be back after these.
Okay. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Yeah, and I see Lise Hand saying here that Ireland has museums. Lise is one of a number of women who have been campaigning for this museum for years, saying Ireland has museums for dinosaurs, country life and rugby. It's time we had one for women. Well said, Lise Hand. Nominations still coming in. If you have one, we'd love to hear from you. 51551 is the text line, and our WhatsApp number is 087 184 3709. Geraldine, have we got Geraldine now?
You have. Good afternoon, Katie.
Geraldine,
can you hear me?
I'm delighted to hear your nomination because it is somebody that I have huge, huge admiration for.
Yes, indeed. A journalist like yourself, Katie, and a trailblazer that I haven't heard of anything that she has been remembered in. You know, so it would be a wonderful opportunity. I'm talking about Mary Raftery, who broke a lot of stories about, in particular, the main one, I suppose, was Dear Daughter, the story of Christina Buckley, so, and the Gordon Bridge Orphanage and ill treatment of children and mothers and all that sort of thing.
Do you know, I don't think the Golden Bridge one was actually one of Mary's. It was during that period, right? The States of Fear was Mary's one, which was an absolute breakthrough, moment, I think, in Irish. Social life in Irish broadcasting. It really, really brought us to a new understanding of what had been happening.
She passed away prematurely as well, you know, and there was so much more I'm sure she would have contributed, only that, she was taken early in life, which was sad, you know, for her, for us all, for her family in particular. But I haven't heard of any. At the time the Rosie Hackett Bridge was named, I would have loved if, you know, she was on my mind that time, you know, that something like that would have been called after around Dublin, you know. So I think it would be a wonderful opportunity to have her remembered in the women's museum, that she'd have to be remembered for the work she did, the journalistic work she did. And she did it at a time when, stories like that were slow, you know, that there was a wee bit of hold back on them, you know.
I think now, I suppose, because we've been reporting on it for so long, it's easy to forget that, you know, she absolutely broke the silence in relation to this. States of Fear was, of course, about institutional abuse. Cardinal Secrets, about clerical abuse. You know, she really, if it wasn't for her, we wouldn't have had the commission into, you know, to inquire into child abuse. I knew her a little in here, back 20 years ago. And she was just an extraordinarily determined.
We forget how difficult it was to break those stories in those days. So it's very important the story is told, or the persons that were brave enough to break those stories, how brave they were. And they should certainly be remembered, you know.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, she was absolutely fearless, and you had to be fearless because you were up against a time. It was still a time when the institution of the state and the institution that was the church were still hugely, you know, significantly powerful. And she really did groundbreaking work in terms of challenging that. It's what journalism is all about, and what, you know, let me just say it out there, what public service broadcasting is all about. And so she's somebody
The very idea of you spending the last few days highlighting the need for a women's museum is excellent in its own way, Katie. So thanks. Thanks for that. You're doing your own bit. And it's good that you got honoured with Person of the Year in Kerry too. So well done on that. You tried to get through to me earlier, and I'm actually in the heart of the Ring of Kerry near Cahar Danielda, so I couldn't get through to you earlier. Oh, it's beautiful, but my phone was dying and all the rest, so I was doing a bit of perseverance work myself to get through with Mary's name.
Fair play to you, Geraldine.
Anyway.
Fair play to you.
It's a beautiful county.
It is beautiful. You're not a Kerry woman yourself, are you?
I'm not. I'm a Cork woman living in Clare.
Okay, right. But you have to get you. So you have to go through the most beautiful county in Ireland to get home, yeah?
No, I've two beautiful counties in my background, namely Clare and Cork. So I can appreciate other beautiful counties.
Right, let's okay.
say. I won't drop the rivalry.
Okay. Listen.
I genuinely, in all seriousness, do believe that Mary should be remembered in some form or another. And I don't know of any other institution that has, you know, has any solid memorabilia or, you know, memory stuff of her.
The only one I'm aware of, Geraldine, there is a bursary. There is a Mary Raftery Journalism Award that is awarded for investigative journalism, which is fantastic. And it is a very inappropriate award given, what Mary stood for and all her work. But you're absolutely right. There should be more, because she's a hugely important figure in Irish life over the last half a century, for sure.
Yes, and her story put in the context of the time that she lived in, that how difficult it was to break those stories.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay.
Geraldine, thanks a mil. Really appreciate that.
Okay, I'm going back.
Go back and enjoy. Enjoy yourself down there now in the Ring of Kerry.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Take care. Are we going to Cliona now? Yeah, Cliona, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
In the same vein, actually, Cliona, you want to nominate a hugely important figure from that time as well.
My mother, Christine Buckley.
Oh, Cliona, it's you. Oh, sorry, I didn't even realise it was yourself. I just thought you were calling in randomly.
Okay.
It's so funny because the Geraldine there mentioning Golden Bridge, and I have such a memory of interviewing your mother for the Evening Herald just before that documentary went on air.
And we got your articles, would you believe, from the religious. The religious had them on file.
Honestly, I was I still to this day remember being so affected by your mother, being just totally just blown away by her strength of character, by the way she expressed herself. She was an extraordinary woman, Cliona.
Yeah, and it would be her 10-year anniversary of her death next year, 2024.
God, that's hard to believe now.
It's flown in all right. I remember when she spoke to Gay Byrne in November 1992.
Yeah, so that...
And spoke about Golden Bridge, and there were other women to join her that day, and her father was live on the radio that day, and Gay Byrne gave them 50 minutes of his time. I know they had to have ad breaks as well, but he was a very good listener. And originally, the other survivors were supposed to come on with Mum, and they were originally just going to talk about Golden Bridge. But then the floodgates opened, and all survivors from all over Ireland from 1992 went speaking. And obviously, Mum could only speak about her own experience or only speak about Golden Bridge. She couldn't speak about the mother and baby homes at the time, even though she had been in Blackrock, in Temple Hill, mother and baby home, from 3 weeks of age until four. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't speak about Magdalen refuges or various Magdalen laundries, as they were known at the time, because she hadn't been there and her own mother hadn't been there. But she had great empathy with so many survivors. She was a nurse in training, qualified nurse who trained in midwifery as well. So she trained in Drogheda in nursing, in general nursing, and then went back to the Rotunda to train in midwifery. Mm-hmm. Well, so she had great empathy from her nursing experience.
But she was just the most It was great to remind us of that Gay Byrne had her on, and that she, because I'm not surprised that she, because she could hold, she was the most compelling communicator. She was extraordinary in terms of being able to express, you know, just take you back to that time, and to speak for all the others who had been through that, you know, in a way that maybe others who had, you know, come out of those institutions couldn't have put words on.
Also, she didn't find much in the way of change between 1996 and 1995. So she agreed with Louis Benton to make a documentary in 1995, and it was first broadcast in February 1996. And it was Dear Daughter documentary. And Mary Rafferty had seen that and availed of mum and her contacts for help, the background help, to create the State's Affair for 1999. So between 1996, mum's broadcast with Louis Lenton, and 1999, my mum, Christine Buckley, was helping with Mary Rafferty meeting with other survivors and contacts, setting up contacts for other survivors from other institutions.
Yeah, because I do recall that that was actually when I first met Christine, was just before the Dear Daughter documentary was going on air. And I was just randomly sent out to your house to talk to Christine. And
there was an RT guide as well. There was RT guide with photographs as well.
Yes. And but as I say, it was just it's literally one of those interviews, and it's obviously quite a long time ago now. But I remember it so vividly because it was a moment where I knew that it was going to change things. I knew that that interview and that documentary was going to have a massive impact. It was just one of those moments in time where you get a sense that this is going to have, you know, this is going to go beyond what we think. You know, this is not just a story. This is huge. And it was.
For any of your listeners as well, if they hadn't seen the documentary and they think it's not available because they might have had it on an old VHS tape or something like that, it's free via the IFI player. So the Irish Film Archive in the city centre have it online. And it's free. They don't have to subscribe or sign up for a membership. And the Dear Daughter documentary from 1996 is there, but also other Louis Lenton survivor stories and stolen childhood and stolen lives, and another couple of stories he collaborated with. Mary Rafferty are on file there. And that was thanks to Ronit Lenton, his wife, who donated all of his original reels to the IFI Irish Film Archive. So not only survivor stories, but other stories that he was working on, the documentaries he was working on.
That is fantastic to know that. And to know, after this programme, I'm going straight on to the IFI webpage to check that out, Cliona. And just to say, like, after that, Christine basically dedicated the rest of her life to representing people who had come through these institutions.
She did her best on a voluntary basis. So, as I say, because she didn't have experience directly in Magdalen Laundries or any of those places, she couldn't speak for them, but she wanted to give them a voice, and she wanted them to speak to journalists and speak to the airwaves and speak from their own experience. So she believed in survivor experiences, survivors telling their own stories. And she also went to Europe, and she won Volunteer of the Year in 2009 for all her years of dedication. So she had cancer for 30 years, and it came back in different parts of her body over the 30 years. But she still did her best for survivors, even if that meant going into Department of Health meetings on a drip, an IV drip, or if that meant meeting the Department of Education when she wasn't well or she was post-chemo. So she did her best, and the reason she did this was because she thought that they had no one else. She thought that they had no other voice. She thought they had no one else to stand up for them.
Yeah.
Trinity recognised her in 2012 by giving her an honorary doctorate in law. And her own father, who was Nigerian, studied medicine in Trinity in the 1940s. So I know that meant a lot to her. But she was also doing various subjects as an evening student and as a day student, full-time registered student in UCD. So she was engaged in full-time education as well. So I don't know how she did it all in terms of volunteering and helping out and studying and going back to college.
Yeah, she was incredible, incredible achievements, an incredible woman, and a very, very worthy nomination there for a place in that museum, should we get one. Cliona, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really great to talk to you, and really great.
Thanks for listening.
No, just really great.
My mom had great time for you, so thanks again, Katie. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, she was an amazing woman. Thanks, Cliona. Take care.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to bring in Rosita Sweetman now. Rosita, how are you?
Hi, Katie. Hello. Excuse me. Hi.
You wanted to re-nominate Maureen De Burca.
Well, just to say that it was actually Maureen who conceived of the Irish Women's Movement and founded it and was central to everything that happened in its short life. Like, it only was there for 9 months. But when Maureen was in prison, she said it was the first time she'd had time to think in years.
Sorry, and just to remind people, in case they missed the earlier part, this is for throwing eggs at the Nixon motorcade.
Yeah. which landed. Maureen was astonished, but she said she couldn't hit a barn door. But they landed, and the guards then nabbed her, and this old woman down on the keys was saying, throw her in the lippy. But she survived. But she did get put into Mountjoy for 3 months, which she said was one of the most horrendous experiences of her life. But when she was in there, she thought, why am I fighting for civil rights in America, gay rights, housing? Why am I not fighting for my own sex, for women's rights? And that was really the germ of the idea for the Irish Women's Liberation Movement. And when she came out, then she met up with Margaret Guy, who ran Guy's Restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and who gave us the premises for the women's movement for the next 9 months. And yeah, that was the start of it.
And why was it only 9 months, Rosita?
It was partly, I think, we were all very involved in other things. Like, a lot of the people were working journalists. You know, everybody was super involved in other things. And it kind of... Mary Kenny left then to go back to London, and that was a big sort of, had a big impact, because we were a very small, tight-knit group. And then one by one, people went off to do other stuff. But I think the seeds were sown. And for instance, the invasion of the 40-foot, that was Irish Women Unite, who grew out of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement. And just to say, it wasn't easy peasy. Like, there was ferocious pushback from the men. Like, Nell remembers them, these naked owl fellas, you know, wagging their genitals at the young feminists who came in, walloping them with wet towels, screaming at them. Like, it was pretty vicious. And it took about, I think there were 4 separate invasions, and then finally they conceded. I think it'd be an amazing idea to have a plaque, or even better, a little monument to the women who liberated the 40-foot. There's nobody out there now, like all the people enjoying it. And it's been named as one of the 10 best swimming holes in the world. Nobody really knows, you know, that it was got back from these naked owl fellas. So, yeah. And I think the idea of a women's museum is a wonderful one. Like, it was heartbreaking listening to Christine Buckley's daughter there. Jesus, what her mum went through And what all the women in the mother and baby homes, in the Magdalene laundries, you know, still being abused, still not being getting proper reparation. Like, it's a terrible legacy in Ireland. So, yeah, I think it'd be a great idea to have a women's museum.
Yes, indeed. I think we've established, if today's show is anything to go by, we have established that we have plenty of support for it and plenty of takers for spots in it as well. Rosita, that's great. Thank you so much. Appreciate that extra background on Maureen De Burke there. Are we going to Anne now? Yeah, Anne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You're nominating?
Well, I'm nominating three ladies whom I suppose rescued from oblivion through their biographies, and these are Grace O'Malley, known as the Pirate Queen of Ireland, Eleanor Countess of Desmond, whom let people perhaps know less of, but made a huge impact on her life, and she was the wife of the great rebel Earl of Desmond. She lived from around 1545 to 1638. Mm-hmm. And more recently, a lady who does tend to get overlooked by our music authorities, and that is Margaret Burke Sheridan, the famous Irish prima donna. And her dates are from 1889 to 1958. So I would recommend these three historic ladies for various reasons.
Okay, well, Grace O'Malley, I suppose, needs no introduction, in fairness. Every school child has learned about the Pirate Queen.
Stage, yes, she's restored now at last to the pages of her history, but she wasn't, and that was the reason I set out to try and find her.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, she absolutely would deserve a place. It's hard to imagine a museum of Irish women that wouldn't have Grace O'Malley in it. I must say, I haven't heard much about the Countess of the Earl of Desmond. There's a hotel actually down in just outside Tralee called the Earl of Desmond. But Eleanor doesn't get much of a look in the old Earl of Desmond story, in fairness.
No, she doesn't. I came upon her actually through Grace O'Malley, because one of the second time in her life that she was actually imprisoned, Grace O'Malley, when she led a plundering raid on the lands of the Earl of Desmond, she was imprisoned in Askeaton Castle, and she met Eleanor, and they ended up actually by being related through marriage. So it's an extraordinary story, and it was through Grace O'Malley that I came upon Eleanor. And what set her apart from other women in that period, Katie, was she was a prolific letter writer, which was most unusual for women in the 16th century. And through her letters, I got very close to Eleanor, because it made a very big difference to actually read her personal letters rather than reading documents about her by other people. She was an extraordinary, really, a heroine of the Tudor Wars in Ireland, got involved in the Munster plantation, all of that, lost from being one of, I suppose, the wealthiest people in Ireland, and certainly her husband was the most powerful. She had to beg her bread on the streets of Dublin. She was reduced to that in the 1580s.
And never
gave up.
Have you written about Eleanor yourself, Anne, or is...
Yes, I have a biography.
You have a biography of her as well.
Eleanor, Countess of Desmond, yes.
Because people will know your biography of Grace O'Malley, obviously.
Mm. Yes, well, Eleanor is, as I say, lesser known, but nonetheless, I mean, her life really is a testimony to the struggle of a courageous and spirited and indeed enduring woman, because she outlived all of her last, I suppose, she outlived all her adversaries was really her greatest triumph, really, and lived to be an incredible age into her 90s in the 16th century, which itself was extraordinary, because the life expectancy of women in the 16th century was an average around 40 years.
I actually thought that was a typo when I saw it written down. Did she actually live that long? Is that recorded in history? That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Absolutely. And made her way over to the court of Elizabeth, who actually took pity on her in the way. And we have, she also gives us a different aspect. Indeed, as Grace O'Malley did as well, had to visit Queen Elizabeth. And they, as women, they got on very, very well together. And Elizabeth did make some provision for her. But of course, what she lost, what Eleanor lost, was quite extraordinary, really. But kept close to her family. And really, she really is, I suppose, what she what she endured during that awful time of trauma in Ireland. You know, the Tudor conquest of Ireland tends to get overlooked because there's no great nationalistic flag. It's all about one thing we can all identify with, and that is survival. And Eleanor was that great survivor. You know, and for women in Bosnia and Somalia and Afghanistan and Palestine and everywhere else today, they're suffering too what she suffered. So I often see, you know, how these ladies from the past, how they can become so relevant and inspirational to women today. And that was why I would like to see Eleanor and Grace part of this great new development now. And also, may I add, Margaret Burke Sheridan, who achieved things in the 1920s in opera in Italy that made her the most famous Irish person of the time, because very few people in Europe at the time knew much about Ireland.
Again, I am ashamed to say, Anne, I had never heard of Margaret Burke Sheridan.
Well, that's such a shame now.
I know.
She was born in my hometown of Castlebar, and that's how I got all her papers. Indeed, the late Garrett Brown had all of her papers, indeed all her beautiful operatic memorabilia, which I still have here, and I'm waiting, hopefully, for a place to put them. So hopefully that this historic museum might take on some of these as well.
Well, there you are. And a famous Irish opera singer from that period that I'm now going to have to look up when I get off air. And another book I have to read, because I absolutely want to know more about Eleanor as well. And fascinating. Thank you so much. Excellent, excellent nominations and suggestions for the museum. That's Anne. I think I can bring in Patrick now. Patrick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Okay, Patrick, you have another nomination for us?
I have, yeah. I'd like to nominate a woman very little known about, Jennifer Bridey Wren, born in Tarmont, Tarbert, in 1917. And in 1970, she became the first woman elected to Pakistan's National Assembly.
She was,
you probably haven't heard of her.
I actually have heard of her. I can now say I have heard of Bridey Wren, but an unbelievably extraordinary story.
Yeah, she was a tribal leader, a peace activist, a strong campaigner for women's rights, education, health and better living conditions in Pakistan. She was known as Mummy Jennifer, the Queen of Baluchistan. And she died in 2008, and she's buried in Peshin in Pakistan. And she introduced, in a land where there was no refrigeration, she introduced an ice factory in Baluchistan. She acted for an intermediary for the rebels when they were in revolt against Bhutto. And she was a signatory of Pakistan's 1973 constitution. So she was an amazing woman. And she was known, as I said, the Queen of Baluchistan, and she was buried in Pakistan. She had an extraordinary journey. She was born to small farmers in Carmen's Tarbert in 1917. She was one of six children. And in 1939, she emigrated to London to train as a nurse. And in London, she met Qazi Muhammad Musa in Oxford. She met him at a ball there, and he was reading philosophy, and the two became very friendly, and she was a very strong-headed woman, and she married Qazi, and they moved to Baluchistan. Baluchistan was an Irish province in Pakistan. But it was there was no women's rights, or there was no there was very little schooling, very poor education, very poor health. Living conditions were bad. So she set about changing all that. And then, sadly, her husband died in 1956 in a car crash. They had the only car in the province of Baluchistan. There was all camels in the province of Baluchistan. And when her husband died, she wanted to return back to Ireland, back to Kerry. But the people of Baluchistan, they wanted Mummy Jennifer, as they called her, to stay on as the Queen of Baluchistan. And she came into conflict then with the tribal chieftains who were in revolt against Ali Bhutto. He was the ruler of Pakistan, and they were in revolt against him, and he was putting down the revolt, and she became the intermediary between the rebels and Bhutto to negotiate conditions. And Bhutto said, "Is this, does this woman think she's the queen of Baluchistan?" He said, "Fix that woman. I want to have nothing more to do with her." But she negotiated for her province, and she managed to gain significant rights.
And she lived. And she lived out her days out there. Patrick, I'm going to have to go because I have one more break to take. But I love this. I love that nomination. And as I said, I had come across Bridie Wren before, and I'm always fascinated by her. And why I love this is that we're hearing about women today that may. That people really need to hear about because they're fantastic stories. So, Patrick, thanks for that. We'll take our last break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're nearly out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in, Annie. You wanted to nominate somebody very close to you.
Hi, Katie, yeah. I'd like to nominate my aunt, Sister Eugenius Colbert, a woman of, selfless service in the missions and of that era that you've spoken about already today. She was born in 1922, a baby of the state, and she passed in 2020 in the first lockdown of COVID, spending 40 years in Africa and 75 years as a missionary sister. She built two hospitals in Africa. She started out as a midwifery sister in a one-roomed antenatal clinic in Ghana. And just, she felt she had organisational skills, and she kind of worked on it and built up a hospital, a teaching hospital for student midwives in Ghana. And then she was, when she had that completed, she was a sister of the Our Lady of Apostles sisters in Artfoil in County Cork. And she actually was then sent to Nigeria, Benin City, St. Philomena's Hospital. She built that up. As well, I suppose she said her organisational skills.
I'm going to have to cut short the nomination, Annie. She sounds amazing, and is one of, as we said earlier, some amazing sisters and nuns that were in this country over the last since the foundation of the state. But that's your aunt, Sister Eugenius Colbert. That's all for today. I want to thank my team. They've been with me all week. I'll see you again on Monday. But for now, I will hand you over to Ray.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.